The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 29, 2025. As usual, the front cover border is in red with a narrow white inner border. Additionally, the rest of the front page is in red also. Time is in large block print lettering, capital lettering. It's in black against this red background. The red, however, is embellished with black, so instead of a black and white photograph on the cover, it is a red and white photograph on the cover. It shows a mob of people, a crowd of people. They seem to all be standing and looking at and perhaps listening to one individual who is seated on a high chair in a tent. And on the tent are the letters that create the words, the American Comeback Tour. On the edge of the tent, prove me wrong, prove me wrong. This may pertain to the killing of Charlie Kirk, because it says on the cover, the killing of Charlie Kirk and the epidemic of American political violence, which I will not be reading right now. Instead, I will be looking at The View, Society, United States of Football, by Todd Rogers and Audrey Feldman. Let's see if anybody else. Here we go. Rogers is professor of public policy, and Feldman is a doctoral student at Harvard University. Being a pro football fan can be good for you and for those around you. As a new NFL season begins, you don't have to know the difference between a cover 4 and a Tampa 2 defense to put on a hat. Make a friend at the shop and build a new family tradition. In an era marked by epidemics of loneliness and political distrust, sports fandom is one simple and universally accessible medicine. Again, this is written by Todd Rogers and Audrey Feldman. We have seen it firsthand. Todd once spotted someone in a Philadelphia Eagles hat at a local shop and instinctively shouted, "Go Birds!" The reply came back instantly, "Go Birds!" A few minutes later, Todd had invited his new friend George and his son to his family's weekly watch parties. They showed up with cheesesteaks, and by the end of the season, more of George's family had joined. These stories are not unusual. More than 70% of Americans consider themselves football fans. Over a third think Super Bowl Sunday should be a national holiday, and half say the Monday after should be a paid day off. The NFL is not just the most watched entertainment. The NFL, it says, is not just the most watched entertainment in America. It is one of the country's last unifying institutions. On any given Sunday, tens of millions of Americans tune in, creating a shared national ritual that cuts across differences. For those who care about social connection and civic life, fandom is a surprisingly powerful path to both. Decades of research show fans have wider friendship networks, stronger feelings of belonging, less alienation. Ben Valenta and David Sikorjuk called their book fans have more friends, and it includes national survey evidence that fans place more trust in their neighbors and in the institutions that keep their communities running. Psychologist Daniel Wan has shown that identifying with a team helps people meet core needs like belonging, identity, and meaning. A 2023 study found attending live sporting events was linked to higher life satisfaction, less loneliness, and a stronger sense that life is worthwhile. Gains similar to those from landing a new job after being unemployed. And one UK field experiment found Manchester United fans were nearly three times more likely to stop and help an injured jogger if he wore their team's shirt rather than a rival's or no shirt at all. Taken together, the data show fandom helps people connect, trust, and step up for others. These bonds matter because many of the groups that once knit American communities together have been unraveling. As Robert Putnam documented in Bowling Alone, the decline of churches, neighborhood associations, bowling leagues that once anchored civic life has coincided with shrinking trust, both in one another and in democratic institutions. The loneliness epidemic declared by the Surgeon General in 2023 underscored the stakes. Social isolation can shorten lives and harm health. At the same time, Americans increasingly live in ideological silos. Democrats cluster with Democrats, Republicans with Republicans. We shop for different brands, watch different shows, consume different news. Social media and polarization make it all too easy to avoid people who see the world differently. Few institutions still attract large, diverse, and deeply engaged groups. Professional sports, and especially football, is the rare exception. Week after week, people who might otherwise have little reason to cross paths come together as fans. In 2024, 18 of the 20 most watched television broadcasts were NFL games. The only other entries were one presidential debate and the Oscars. Last year's opening weekend averaged 21 million viewers per game. Liberals and conservatives follow football at nearly equal rates, as do men and women, and people of different racial and ethnic groups. Many fans even rank their team loyalty as central to their identity, on par with religion or politics. The NFL has real problems, from head trauma to racial disparities in leadership. Until 1946, black players were effectively banned. These problems need fixing, as the civic benefits of today's fandom are too meaningful to ignore. It is hard to think of any other institution that's so broadly representative of the country and so passionately embraced. There are endless ways to join in, from swapping texts during games to trash-talking with friends in fantasy leagues to, yes, striking up a conversation with a stranger. So wear your jersey with pride. You may be greeted with a spontaneous skull, gang green, or go birds. Returning the cheer is a small step toward strengthening your community and maybe making a new friend to watch with next week. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. Just 3 months ago, Israel and Iran fought a 12-day war that shook the Middle East. Missiles and drones flew in both directions, but with a major assist from the U.S., Israel established dominance of Iran's airspace, repeatedly struck nuclear and military targets across Iran, and killed 30 security commanders and 19 of Iran's nuclear scientists. Iran's retaliation accomplished little that might deter Israel in the future. A return to war is unlikely, though Iran likely retains a stockpile of enriched uranium and the means to rebuild enrichment capability. The Israeli-American bombing campaign ensured it's now several years away from being able to produce a nuclear weapon. Israel has also essentially normalized direct strikes inside Iran's borders and demonstrated its ability to inflict significant damage to the regime. Israel can carry out limited mow-the-grass operations if Iran makes sudden progress in rebuilding its nuclear program, and it can strike more missile bases and air defense systems to keep Iran's defenses down. For its part, Iran cannot afford war. It will retaliate if and when Israel strikes again, but the response will be carefully calibrated to avoid a dangerous escalation it is less able to fend off. Iran is in a far weaker geopolitical position today than it was before October 7, having lost much of its allied network from Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon to Bashar Assad in Syria, that Tehran had long relied on to deter Israel and project power regionally. For now, the Iranian regime remains stable. The country's water and energy shortages have triggered a few demonstrations, but a post-war security force crackdown has prevented any re-eruption of the Woman, Life, Freedom protests that rocked the country in 2022. Any return to high-intensity war might jeopardize the regime's control. Yet even if Iran can avoid another war, pressure on its economy and therefore the regime is about to go up. Iran faces the imminent snapback of UN sanctions. At the end of August, the three European governments that signed the 2015 deal to block development of a nuclear weapons program, Britain, France, and Germany, triggered the return of UN sanctions on Iran in response to its decision to halt cooperation with inspectors. Barring an unlikely diplomatic breakthrough, these sanctions will be reimposed October 18, just after the snapback deadline expires. Washington has already hit Iran's oil and mining sectors and banned the use of U.S. dollars in commercial transactions. The EU has also imposed penalties over the violent suppression of past protests and Iran's military support for Russia's war on Ukraine. But UN sanctions would be far more sweeping and likely to cause a considerable decline in Iran's oil revenues and put additional pressure on its economy. Iran has signaled to the Trump administration it is open to talks, but the White House appears set on squeezing Tehran further before new bargaining can begin. The official U.S. position is that Iran must first make major concessions on uranium enrichment, and such a climb down is unlikely. In the meantime, Washington can use the threat of U.N. snapback sanctions to push Iran's leadership deeper into a corner. Tehran's not without sympathizers and clients, though the U.S. has slapped sanctions on those who move Iranian oil. China continues to discreetly buy the country's crude. Its major energy companies and banks remain effectively walled off from Iran oil trade, which limits their risks of penalties. But the bigger picture for Iran's oil revenue is darkening as other potential buyers hang back. Floating storage tankers containing Iranian oil that have no current destination surged from 5 million barrels to 30 million over the first half of 2025. At the very least, that means Iran will have to offer bigger discounts and accept lower revenues to attract more takers. The Islamic Republic has weathered many storms since the 1979 revolution and may well survive a few more. In the wake of the recent Iran-Israel war, Tehran has worked hard to sell survival as victory, but the troubles are only going to grow. The View Inbox CO2 Leadership Report by Justin Warland, Senior Correspondent. The Trump administration filed plans in early September to cancel approval for two large wind farm projects off the coast of New England, which represent an estimated value of nearly $15 billion and a source of new electricity in a time of growing demand. And the full-throated push against wind is more than an anti-climate move. By targeting investments that are already in train and in some cases close to completed, President Trump's action strikes against the core of the free market and private enterprise. While past administrations have certainly changed subsidies and regulatory requirements, targeting projects with active construction presents an unprecedented level of regulatory uncertainty. Permitted energy projects of any type should not be halted at such a late stage, Martin Durbin, Senior Vice President of Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, wrote in a September 3 blog post. Revoking wind permits today opens the door to uncertainty for all types of energy projects in the future. The message to anyone making a big capital investment: the success of your project may depend on Trump's favor. Under these conditions, it will be hard not only to invest in the energy transition at scale, but also to build a whole lot of necessary infrastructure. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Senior Correspondent. When Donald Trump has spoken of late, many Americans have been less interested in his words than his appearance. Is he wearing more makeup than usual? Any new bruises? Is he steady? It is perhaps a reasonable response after so much talk circulating this summer about whether Trump is at death's door or through it. After years of being told Trump is a model of health, an exemplar of youth, and a man always in his prime, some are feeling a tad skeptical about his well-being. So much so, the public is conditioned to doubt even their own eyes when it comes to Trump's existence. After all, earlier this year, the White House physician praised the president's health by boasting that he logs frequent victories in golf events. During his first term, doctors kept him just 1 pound away from being classified as obese, but said he was nevertheless a machine. Some people just have great genes. I told the president if he had a healthier diet over the last 20 years, he might live to be 200, Dr. Ronnie Jackson said in 2018, years before being elected to Congress. During the 2016 campaign, Trump's personal physician released a letter lauding his excellent health, one that Trump himself dictated, it was later reported. So it's completely understandable that doubters of all stripes would buy into the false rumors of Trump's imminent or possibly recent demise. They build upon the White House's announcement Trump has been diagnosed with chronic venous insufficiency. Big handshake energy was the excuse offered up for the clear bruising on his hands, despite visible makeup deployed to hide it. During an August 15 Alaska summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin, questions emerged about Trump's gait. That's G-A-I-T. I didn't see that, Trump said September 2, brushing off a question about his noted scarcity over the Labor Day weekend. For that media-obsessed president, the protest rings hollow, but it also underlines a dynamic that should make Americans, regardless of party affiliation, take notice. When Trump came to power in 2017, 49% of Americans saw him as not honest or trustworthy, according to YouGov polling. The same survey now finds 56% do not believe what he says. In fairness, CNN's final poll on Bill Clinton's presidency had 58% of Americans saying he was not honest or trustworthy. Presidencies crumble when they lose credibility. President George W. Bush arguably never recovered after he seemed untethered from reality in the response to 2005's Hurricane Katrina. It is why Republicans thought they had their version of that when Barack Obama seemed to drift in 2012 after the attack in Benghazi, Libya. Joe Biden aborted his re-election bid last year after a public meltdown on a debate stage. The last example has even Trump's fanboys asking questions. There's obviously something going on with Trump that the White House is covering up. Nick Fuentes, a white nationalist and influential far-right figure, asserted on social media, "This is literally Biden too." Trump and his team have tried to dismiss the comparison, but these things tend to snowball. Trump knows this. On Election Day 2016, 61% of voters told the exit polls they did not think Hillary Clinton was honest or trustworthy. But here's the rub. 64% said the same of Trump, and he went on to victory. Trump has always been a healthy exception to the rules of politics, including, it seems, even on his health. In the Loop by Billy Perigo, correspondent. At a lakefront venue in Sweden in August, 18 individuals from OpenAI, Google DeepMind, the UK AI Security Institute, the OECD, and other groups gathered for an invite-only summit on the agenda, arriving at an understanding of the likely ways AI will impact the social contract between working people, governments, and corporations. One outcome of the so-called Artificial General Intelligence Social Contract Summit was a list of four draft statements. They paint a grim picture of where the world could be headed, absent significant interventions by governments and societies. AI is likely to exacerbate increasing wealth and income inequality within countries, worsening economic conditions for many working and middle-class people and families, the first reads. AI will increase inequality between countries that have access to AI infrastructure and those that do not, both in terms of access to benefits as well as ability to respond to shocks, says the second. Without intervention, AI-enabled inequalities may lead to the political dominance of wealthy individuals and corporations, eroding democratic institutions and increasing levels of political dissatisfaction, the third says. And the fourth, the encroachment of AI systems and the erosion of the value of labor could lead to the increasing disempowerment of most humans, causing a degradation in individual well-being and purpose. The attendees, who were present in their personal capacities, not as official representatives of their organizations, agreed between saunas that the existing social contract, in which people receive security and a stake in society in return for their labor, could be in trouble because of AI, says Derek Cheng. He's director of research at the Windfall Trust, a nonprofit founded this year to grapple with these issues. "We are essentially worried that labor will be disempowered relative to corporations, and also to some degree that governments might be disempowered relative to corporations," Cheng says. "The obvious result of lower labor power is decreased real wages." This view holds that people in wealthy democracies enjoy a high standard of living, not because of their rights enshrined on paper, but because of their ability to withhold their labor. Fortunately, attendees also identified several possible actions that governments could take to push things in a better direction. For example, developing new institutions in the vein of the IMF to ensure that wealth derived from AI is distributed globally rather than within the one or two powerful countries where AI companies are located. States could also run pilots today for policies like basic income and reduced working weeks to gather evidence about what kinds of safety nets are effective. The View essay, Climate, Patagonia's Idea of a Global Investment, by David Gels. Excerpted from Dirtbag Billionaire, How Yvon Chouinard Built Patagonia, Made a Fortune and Gave It All Away, by David Gels. That's G-E-L-L-E-S. Copyright 2025 by David Gels. Reprinted by permission of Simon & Schuster, Inc. There's a photograph here, about half a page. It's in color. It's really exciting because the sky is blue, and beneath that blue sky are tall green trees with very slender trunks, and below that is a greeny, grassy soil. And below that is a blue pond reflecting all of these tall, slender, green trees. The caption reads, "The Okefenokee Swamp is home to threatened and endangered species like the indigo snake and wood stork." And I may be abbreviating this article, which is an essay. Earlier this year, a titanium mine was slated for construction on the edge of Georgia's Okefenokee Swamp, an unusually diverse ecosystem that is home to some of the country's most pristine wetlands. If built, the mine would likely have unleashed catastrophic pollution in the area. Then in June, the project was called off. In a stunning deal, the company behind the mine announced it had reached a $60 million agreement to sell the site of the proposed project to a group of conservationists. There would be no titanium mining on the edge of the Okefenokee after all. It was a hefty price to pay for a tract of backwater marshland, but the conservationists had deep-pocketed backers, including Patagonia, the outdoor apparel brand founded by rock climber Yvon Chouinard. $2 million of the funds used to protect Okefenokee came from the Hold Fast Collective, a group of nonprofit entities that since 2022 has donated the profits generated by Patagonia to nonprofit groups fighting climate change. It is an arrangement unlike almost anything else in corporate America. Rather than distributing earnings to shareholders or letting executives keep the money for themselves, Patagonia gives away most everything it makes. That kind of philanthropy is unusual. The kind of philanthropy is unusual in an age when many billionaires flaunt their wealth with mega yachts and Wall Street firms work to extract profits from their investments. But it's a structure that's in keeping with Patagonia's unique history of charity and conservationism. Back in 1972, when Chouinard was still making rock climbing gear, he heard about a plan to divert and develop the mouth of the Ventura River, which flowed just behind his office and then into the Pacific Ocean, shaping one of the best surf breaks in California. If the plan went ahead, the waves that drew Chouinard to Ventura in the first place could be gone. Beyond the waterway's importance to the surf, Chouinard and his pals knew that as recently as the 1940s, the Ventura had been a major spawning ground for thousands of steelhead trout and Chinook salmon. But over the years, the river had been dammed upstream, drying it up and killing the fish. Schwinor wound up backing a young environmental activist named Mark Capelli, who led an effort to halt development on the Ventura. Thanks to Schwinor's financial backing, the development was halted, the river was protected, the surf break was preserved. Capelli was not a businessman, and Schwinor was not an activist at this point, but the men shared an affinity for nature and a willingness to challenge authority. "We were both marching to our own drummer," Capelli said. The check for Capelli was the first environmental grant Schwinor ever made. One small donation had made a difference, and Schwinor understood for the first time that his money could have an impact. Years later, Earth Day, 1989, Schwinor hosted an activist named Rick Klein at the Patagonia offices in Ventura. Klein, a native Californian who had first visited Chile in the 1970s and fallen in love with the land, had come straight off the plane from South America, and he was there to ask Schwinor for money. He was running an organization called Ancient Forest International, working to preserve old-growth trees around the globe. In particular, he was trying to protect a 1,100-acre swath of forest in southern Chile that was home to ancient araucaria, also known as monkey puzzle trees. Rumor had it that a New Zealand-based timber company wanted to buy the land, situated in the Konya Mountains, and clear-cut the trees to make paper for fax machines. Klein described the land and unfurled a spread of 9 photographs he had taped together, displaying a majestic vista of forests and lakes. "It was a rare opportunity to preserve pristine land," he told Schwinor. Klein had already raised money from another philanthropist. Would Schwinor help? He did not hesitate. Schwinor was in for $40,000. That was an enormous commitment and took even his family by surprise. "It was not a great time for us financially," his wife Melinda Schwinor said. "Is any time a good time to spend an unbudgeted $40,000? Schwinor told Klein if he wanted to raise more money, he should go to San Francisco and hit up Doug Tompkins, his best friend and the founder of another clothing company, Esprit. Schwinor was sure his friend would match his contribution. He was right. When Klein arrived in San Francisco, Tompkins cut the activist a check on the spot. Klein now had most of the funds needed to save a unique stand of ancient forest. As Schwinor grew wealthy thanks to Patagonia's success, he began allocating much of his money to the acquisition of undeveloped land. He built himself homes in exclusive locales, including the foothills of the Tetons in Jackson, Wyoming, and the beach in Ventura. He acquired property in the exclusive Hollister Ranch, north of Santa Barbara, California. But most of his swelling fortune was funneled toward environmental activism and conservation. Along with Tompkins, he bought up vast swaths of Argentina and Chile, helping fund the creation of a new network of national parks. He also contributed to a new protected area on the southernmost tip of Argentina, known as Peninsula Mitre, M-I-T-R-E. And in 2022, Schwinor gave away the company to a series of trusts and nonprofit organizations, including the newly created Hold Fast Collective, which now turns over all of Patagonia's profits to environmental causes, including large-scale conservation. In its first year of operation, Hold Fast made 690 grants and commitments totaling more than $61 million. There were big donations for conservation efforts, including donations to help protect the Viosa River in Albania. The Nature Conservancy got $5.2 million to buy 8,000 acres in the Mobile Tensaw Delta to protect a fragile waterway, and Holdfast has already blocked other mining projects as well. Shortly after Schwinor gave away the company, Greg Curtis, the former Deputy General Counsel Lorenzo of Patagonia, who now runs Holdfast, heard about a campaign to impede the construction of Pebble Mine, a proposed gold and copper mine in Alaska. Within days, Curtis had committed to providing the final $3.1 million needed to buy up some critical parcels of land, scuttling the mining project. In total, the Holdfast funds helped protect 162,710 acres of wilderness around the world in its first year of operation. Now, the money's helping protect the Okefenokee Swamp in Georgia. In some respects, Patagonia has hardly changed since Chouinard founded the company. More than five decades on, Patagonia's profits are still going to grassroots groups working to protect nature, perpetuating with an almost manic level of consistency the approach Chouinard first took when he gave his initial grants to Capelli and the Friends of the Ventura River some 50 years earlier. Yet in restructuring Patagonia to ensure its profits are used to protect wild lands, Chouinard accomplished something remarkable, turning a for-profit corporation with $1 billion in annual sales into one of the biggest environmental philanthropies in the country. It changed the whole way the company operates, he said, of Patagonia's commitment to the environment. We make all decisions based on, is this the right thing for the home planet? Here are the milestones. We have one larger article along with 2, 4, 6, 7 very small items, along with 3 in this column. Milestones resigned, prime ministers, departures routine and not, 3 in this column. Japan. The 11 months that Shigeru Ishiba served was just about half the typical tenure in Japan, where premiership turnover is common. Ishiba's September 7 announcement was presaged by runaway inflation and two consecutive election losses by his Liberal Democratic Party, which has been hampered by financial scandals. For the first time since 1955, the party controls neither legislative chamber. Nepal. There was nothing routine about the departure of K. Pier Sharma Oli, O-L-I. He stepped down September 9 as parliament burned and prisons emptied, a day after 19 people were killed while protesting the government's ban on social media platforms, where Nepal's Gen Z called out corruption and condemned the conspicuous consumption of officials' children, whom they dubbed Nepo kids. In the worst unrest in decades, Oli's house was also torched. France. September 8 resignation of François Bayrou was compelled by a no-confidence vote intended to force embattled President Emmanuel Macron to call new elections. Instead, Macron, wedged between far-right and far-left parties, vowed to revamp his governing coalition and name yet another new prime minister, who would be the fifth for France in less than 2 years. Bayrou, that's B-A-Y-O-R-O-U, had held office only since December. Here's the big article, died. Giorgio Armani changed the course of fashion. Giorgio, G-I-O-R-G-I-O, space, Armani, A-R-M-A-N-I. Belinda Luscombe wrote this. There's a photo here. It's about a fourth of a page. It looks like it should be in black and white, but it's not. The background is in shades of off-white and gray and beige, and there's Armani sitting front and center. He's wearing all black. His hair is all white. He has greenish beige brown eyes. He's not smiling. He's got his chin cupped in his left hand, and he's looking barely askance of the camera, but he's sitting on a brown chair, so it's not quite a black and white photo. When Giorgio Armani, the founder of one of the world's most revered fashion brands, died at 91, September 4, he left behind a legion of extraordinarily beautiful clothes. Few outfits, however, encapsulate his impact, as well as the iconic champagne and silver suit Jodie Foster wore when she won the 1992 Academy Award for Best Actress for her role in The Silence of the Lambs. Foster had entrusted herself to Armani after her 1989 Oscar outfit, an overly fussy blue party dress, made it onto several worst-dressed lists. She did not have to go far. Armani had set up a specialist VIP dressing room on Rodeo Drive following the publicity he got for designing Richard Gere's unstructured suits in American Gigolo. His strategy was working. In 1990, so many celebs, male and female, wore the label for the Oscars that Women's Wear Daily dubbed it the Armani Awards. He was one of the first to see the Oscars as a potent fashion event. The symbiotic relationship he created with celebrities, symbolic also, I suppose, he made them glamorous and they returned the favor, helped him with brand extensions, perfumes, sunglasses, watches that finance many labels, high fashion lines. Other designers, Valentino, Versace, Oscar de la Renta, to name a few, also successfully courted celebrities, but few had as much sway as Armani. Foster's pantsuit, with its flowing lines and subtle blush and cream palette, was classic Armani, impeccable tailoring in service of a relaxed silhouette. She looked like $1 million, but she also looked like she wasn't trying too hard. Later that year, she was on the cover of People's Most Beautiful People issue. The suit also marked a pivot away from the bold looks of the 80s toward a quieter sophistication. Armani was part of a generation of designers who ushered in a less formal fashion era, one that would allow men and women to look refined without looking stuffy. In due course, the informality would take people all the way to grunge and eventually put CEOs of multi-million-dollar companies into hoodies. And as designers tied their fortunes to famous people realized they could sell clothes just by wearing them and started their own lines. The fashion world Armani just departed is different from the one he entered when he started his label in 1975. It's more fragmented, less orderly, more enmeshed in the culture of fame and of never-ending updates, but at least in part, it's a world he helped build. And here is the final milestones column. Engaged, pop superstar Taylor Swift and American football player Travis Kelce. The couple announced the news in an Instagram post August 26. Canonized, Carlo Acutis. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. It's A-C-U-T-I-S, as the Catholic Church's first millennial saint, September 7. Acutis, who died of leukemia at 15 in 2006, developed a website documenting miracles and was credited with two himself. Removed skin cancer lesions from former President Joe Biden in surgery, his spokesperson announced, September 4. Killed at least 2,200 people after three earthquakes shook Afghanistan over several days at the end of August and start of September. More than 3,000 people were injured. Named Chloe Malle, M-A-L-L-E, as new head of editorial content at American Vogue, September 2. Malle, or Maya, succeeds Anna Wintour, longtime leader of the magazine. nicknamed the Department of Defense as Department of War after President Donald Trump signed an executive order September 5, planned an end to school vaccine mandates in Florida, state officials announced September 3. The move would make the state the first to withdraw from the widely accepted public health practice. The brief news environment: are wildfires setting us back on air pollution? By Simone Shaw. Wildfires are reversing the gains made by decades of clean air standards in Canada and the U.S., according to new data published August 28. Researchers at the University of Chicago released their annual Air Quality Life Index, AQLI, which tracks air pollution and how it impacts life expectancies. This year's report analyzed data collected in 2023. That year, as Canada faced its worst wildfire season in history, with more than 40 million acres of land burning, the flames caused air pollution concentrations to rise to levels not seen since the AQLI began recording air quality data, 2011 in the U.S. and 1998 in Canada. Both nations had made great strides in lowering air pollution, but the wildfires reversed that progress. The two countries saw the highest increases in air pollution worldwide in 2023, despite both having strict air quality rules at the time. The fires elevated pollution levels in pockets of the U.S. and also changed the geographical distribution of pollution. The most polluted counties in the U.S. are typically concentrated in California. But in 2023, wildfires caused counties in several other states, including Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, and as far south as Mississippi, to be included among the most polluted. Pollution released into the air from fires and other sources is measured in micrometers, or millionths of a meter. Particles no larger than 2.5 micrometers in diameter are known as PM2.5, and data from AQLI shows concentrations of PM2.5 increased by 1.5% around the world in 2023 compared with 2022 levels, reaching nearly five times the World Health Organization guidelines. Long-term exposures to PM2.5 pollution can increase the risk of heart disease, lung cancer, stroke, and other health conditions. The findings are a stark warning about what could be a new reality for air quality. This year's fire season has been the second worst on record, with a total of 18.5 million acres burned since the beginning of 2025. Climate change is causing an increase in the frequency and intensity of wildfires, with the largest spikes occurring in the western U.S. and the boreal forests of northern North America and Russia, according to a NASA study. This change comes at the same time the Trump administration is working to roll back clean air standards in the U.S. In March, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it plans to undo landmark pollution standards, including the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, which regulate harmful pollutants like particulate matter. The administration has also proposed revoking the 2009 endangerment finding, which determined greenhouse gases were a threat to public health and provided a legal basis for regulating them under the Clean Air Act. Researchers say climate change and air pollution are deeply linked, and that lowering carbon dioxide emissions, which raise global temperatures and worsen wildfires, is an essential part of reducing air pollution. Both climate change and air pollution are driven by the same source: fossil fuel combustion from vehicles, power plants, and industry. researchers wrote in the report. In this respect, reductions in fossil fuel consumption have the potential to decrease air pollution concentrations and the risks of disruptive climate change. There's a small photo in this article. It looks like someone is walking a dog on a sidewalk next to a green space, a level green grass park. It's across a body of water from a skyline that looks somewhat familiar. I won't bank on it, but it looks like the Chrysler Building is there in the background, which means it's New York City. But in the background, this woman who's walking the dog, which is really cute, it's kind of medium in size, and it's fluffy looking like an Alaskan husky with black and tan and white, and its tail is curly. But anyway, the woman's got long dark hair, and she's wearing a bright green shirt and black shorts and white walking shoes, and the skyline is in gray behind her, and the sky is pink. So I think it's meant to indicate a wildfire smoke cloud there. The Bulletin by Callum Sutherland, What Genocide Scholars See in Gaza. August 31, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, IAGS, became the latest organization to address the question of whether Israel's policies and actions in Gaza meet the legal definition of genocide. The government of Israel has engaged in systematic and widespread crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide. Read their resolution, which 86% of members approved. The IAGS resolution cited Article 2 of the United Nations Convention for the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which defines genocide as a crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. It does not include political groups or what is known as cultural genocide. The resolution said Israel's actions in response to the terrorist attack committed by Hamas, October 7, 2023, have not only been directed against Hamas, but have also targeted the entire Gazan population. The IAGS argued Israel has forcibly displaced nearly all of the 2.3 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip multiple times and cited estimates that more than 90% of the housing in the territory has been damaged or destroyed. Israel was previously accused of genocide at the International Court of Justice in a case submitted by South Africa in December 2023. Last November, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as for Ibrahim al-Masri, a Hamas leader Israel said it killed last July, and whose death Hamas confirmed in January. Oren Marmorstein, a spokesperson for Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, rejected the resolution, calling it an embarrassment to the legal profession and to any academic standard. He added, "It is entirely based on Hamas' campaign of lies and the laundering of those lies by others." Israel has previously strongly denied its actions in Gaza constitute genocide, citing its right to defend itself. Netanyahu, in an address August 13, called allegations of genocide ridiculous and a blatant falsehood. This article shares half a page with a half-page photograph. Formation. Here's the caption. China's People's Liberation Army took the world stage September 3 in a massive military parade marking 80 years since the end of World War II. Russia's Vladimir Putin, North Korea's Kim Jong-un, and Iran's Massoud Pezeshkian applauded the show of strength, which included undersea drones, laser air defense systems, and new intercontinental ballistic missiles. The photograph is packed. It's almost a geometric optical illusion. It's packed with soldiers. They're all in dress uniforms. They're all carrying arms over their respective left shoulders with white gloves on. But the way this photograph was taken, which looks to me like it's squarely into the lens, causes this to look like a series of diagonals with these rows of soldiers. They're dressed in dark colors. I'm not sure if I can describe it as khaki. It looks more like a very dark greenish brown, almost as dark as black. And each cap of each soldier has a bold red and gold insignia on it. So these are members of the People's Liberation Army of China. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.